Well, I think right now, women's oppression is a really important topic to discuss because there's obviously been a pretty vicious spike in kind of extreme forms of misogyny alongside the rise of the far right internationally as well. So in April of last year, a guy called Alec Manasin drove his van onto a sidewalk in Toronto and he killed 10 people, 8 of them were women. And 10 minutes earlier, he'd posted on Facebook, "The incel rebellion has already begun." He praised Elliot Rodger, who shot 6 people in a self-declared battle against women and feminists in 2014. I think these two people embody the most dangerous version of the anti-woman incel culture that's been built on message boards like 4chan and Reddit in a resurgence of extreme misogyny both across the world but also, in these internet forums. But as well as that, it's not limited to those forums, so it can be found in heads of state and powerful figures across the world. You can look at Donald Trump, who's obviously very well known for his cry of grab her by the pussy, but as well as that, people might know Jair Bolsonaro, a far-right politician who runs Brazil at the moment, who told a congresswoman that she was too ugly to rape. And then as well as that, all of this extreme misogyny is backed up by the mainstream of society, and it also comes from that. So these extremes can only exist because of generalised, normalised sexism. You have sexualisation of women's bodies, the control of reproduction, you have demeaning stereotypes, and so on. And there's a sort of extreme, they're an extreme version of a reality that actually exists. And despite all of the sort of changes and structural changes that have occurred since the 50s and gains that have been made, women are still oppressed. And for us to say, as Marxists, that women are oppressed, that doesn't just mean in the realm of ideas. Women are talked about in sort of negative ways and these kind of things. It means that there are structures that exist all across society that exist to create and back up the oppression of women. So women are encouraged constantly to be more sexy, to see their bodies as objects that exist purely for the pleasure of men, and that message comes from advertising, from media, politicians, our peers, as well as the existence of entire structural industries that are based upon the sexualization of women. So pornography, lingerie chains, the sex industry, and the list could go on and on. Sexualized women in movies, advertising as well. It goes on. In 1974, Andrea Dworkin described the role of women in porn, and I think her description could also be referring to advertising, media, all these things as well. She said of the women in porn, "She's an object with no control over her own mobility, capable of no assertion of personality. Her body is a body. The same way that a pencil is a pencil, a bucket is a bucket, or as Gertrude Stein famously put it, a rose is a rose." But control over women's bodies and sexuality isn't just made up of this sexualisation. It also extends to control over our reproductive rights. In the United States, people would have seen a huge assault on reproductive rights occurred this year, but as well, people might have noticed that still abortion is on the criminal code in New South Wales. It keeps getting pushed back and back and back when it's actually going to be taken off. But then you can look around Australia and see that it's the reality for a lot of women around the country that they can't access free and easily accessible abortions. In Albury, the last existing abortion clinic was shut down last year because of a right-wing campaign against it. In South Australia, it has to be sort of confirmed by two doctors that you're in, like, a lot of danger or your sort of fetus is in a lot of danger if you continue the pregnancy. You can't just get an abortion because you want one and you've decided that that is what you want to do with your body and your life. As well as that, contraception is obviously a burden that is heavily placed on the shoulders of women. I don't know if people saw this, there was a massive research study into whether it was viable to have men's contraception developed a while ago. And that study was halted because, so it was basically a version of the pill that would mean that they couldn't get women pregnant while they took it. It was stopped because the men reported side effects. Now, these side effects were acne, depression, mood swings. I think a lot of the women in the room would probably recognise those side effects from somewhere. But yeah, for men to have those would be untenable. So we still have to bear the burden of it. Past that, The gender pay gap in gendered industries you can look at, and I'll talk about that later. That's another way that women sort of are pushed into earning lower wages than women than men, having less control over their lives. But then as well as that, women who are also from other oppressed groups experience oppression in a variety of different sort of more intensified ways as well. So you can look in Australia at the extreme underpayment of migrant women, the demeaning stereotypes about black and Aboriginal women. People might have seen in France recently the women who defied a ban on Muslim women from going to the swimming pool because their clothing is too modest, which I think gives an example of the way that racism as well ties in to the oppression of women. So women today are oppressed in society in a whole series of ways. But to be able to understand all of this and fight it properly, we have to look at where it comes from to talk about how to get rid of it. And I think to look at that, the starting point has to be in capitalism. So capitalism is a system which is driven by an anti-human imperative, so profit. Profit drives society rather than human need. And the capitalist class, the ultra-rich, the owners of industry and business will do whatever they can to make a profit. And that means oppressing people in a whole series of ways. So women's oppression, racism, transphobia, the list goes on. And one of the key sort of forms of that is the oppression of women that I think is rooted in the existence of the family under capitalism. So I'll sort of explain that now, and I think it's the most useful framework for understanding where women's oppression comes from in our society. So today, in Australia, but also around the world, women do the majority of household labour and caring for the children. In Australia, couples tend to share the housework sort of relatively evenly until the point where they have kids. And in Australia, married women with children do 66% of the housework and caring for children on average. And that's obviously despite a bit of a change in attitudes around that question in Australia. But it's structurally still kind of a huge part of the system. In order for capitalism to function, capitalists require workers to do labour. Workers produce everything in our society, the buildings, the food, the furniture, this thing. And capitalism can't function without workers. So capitalists as well, for the profits that they need to exist as a class in the first place, the only way they can get those profits is by exploiting workers. But for this to happen in the first place, the system needs workers. So they need to be reproduced. They need to be born, raised, fed, socialised, and so on as children, but also adult workers need to be maintained. They need to be fed, they need to have their clothes washed, they need to have their households maintained. And under capitalism, the way that workers are reproduced and maintained is through the family unit. So by dividing people off into individual units of roughly two parents raising the kids. And with the emergence of capitalism, the nuclear family became integral to reproducing labour. So Chris Harman, who's a Marxist, says, to shore up new family forms, religious leaders and legislators ensured that men and women knew their place in the family. Sexuality became more strictly regulated. Homosexuality and other so-called deviant behaviours were more heavily prescribed. And in that context, Oscar Wilde was famously prosecuted under the Gross Indecency Clause of the Criminal Law Act. So homosexuality and gender deviance became defined and persecuted. Women's role as keepers of the household and raisers of children became entrenched at the same time. So the onus of women was and is placed upon women to do the majority of the work required to reproduce and maintain the workforce required by the capitalist class. A Victorian government study recently showed that if you got all of the unpaid domestic labour that was done, if it was actually paid for, it would be worth $205 billion, or so the equivalent of 50% of the entire gross state product. So 50% of the economy, basically. Another study from 2017 found that women undertook 72% of all unpaid labour in Australia, and the bulk of that unpaid labour is childcare. And they also found that if you took all of that unpaid childcare and you made it into a formal industry like other industries are, it would be Australia's largest industry. And it would be three times the financial and insurance industry, which is the currently the largest industry in the formal economy. So for the ruling class, women's unpaid work as part of the family is totally integral to the functioning of capitalism. And it's not just about the monetary worth of it as well. So it's part of structuring the system. If the family unit was gotten rid of, imagine the enormous restructuring that would have to happen to continue to reproduce labour. You'd have to have mass collectivisation of childcare paid for the state. That would require enormous taxes off on the rich, which they are not going to countenance. But even then, that would be incapable of performing the same detailed socialisation needed to make children and then adults fit into the grotesque system that capitalism is. And then there's a series of other aspects of women's oppression that sort of flow from this and also back it up. So the gender pay gap, for example, is one. The gender pay gap still exists in Australia, despite being sort of illegal technically. It's hovered between around 15 to 20% for the past two decades. As well as that, women in Australia make up the majority of casual workers, but a minority of full-time. Women are pushed into certain industries, and the historical legacy of women being paid less than men, as well as the sexist ideas that still exist around women's work, means that these professions are lower paid. So two examples are the healthcare and social assistance industry. That's 79% women, which is actually up from what it was in the late 90s. As well as that, education and training is 73.2% women dominated, which is also up from what it was in the late 90s. So rather than what we're told about sort of women are like going out into all of these new wonderful industries, actually women are being centralised more and more into these industries. And an industry being women dominated drags down its pay altogether as an industry. But then not only is the whole industry paid lower than male dominated and also mixed industries, as well as that, the fact that it's a sort of women-dominated industry drags down men's pay in those industries as well. But also, women are still paid less than men in those industries. So in women-dominated industries, women earn less on average than men. In mixed industries, women earn less on average than men. In male-dominated industries, women obviously earn less than men. But then there's a question of, do men benefit from this? And there's a lot of theories about women's oppression that argue they do. So patriarchy theory and sort of male privilege ideas argue men benefit from this reality. But I think in reality they don't. So men don't actually pocket the difference between men and women's pay. Instead, it's the capitalists who employ the male and women workers. They profit from the work of all workers and they let workers keep a sort of tiny sum of what they actually produce. Their profits are what they take from workers, and paying women less means that they get to take more from women workers. But as well as that, they can use women's lower wages to drive down men's as well, or to prevent them from asking for a pay rise. Like, oh, you want higher wages? Well, what about the women in this industry who are earning this much? Well, as if that's not going to happen. And historically, that's how it's been used. So it benefits capitalists, not working class men. And that's part of why as well, male trade unionists have often been part of the struggle for equal pay for women. But then as well as that, looking at the other side, women who are part of the capitalist class, they do benefit off women's oppression. It's not like there's this neat divide between men and women. In fact, a lot of women, well, not the minority of women, do benefit from women's oppression and from the gender pay gap. So Gail Kelly, for example, when she was the first woman CEO of Westpac, she made money off the fact that the finance sector has one of the biggest gender pay gaps of any industry. As well as that, despite the enormous amount of women living in poverty or forced into casual work, the richest person in Australia is a woman, Gina Rinehart. That does nothing for any working class woman in any way. In fact, she benefits from an economy which is structured to oppress women. And if that women's oppression was fought against or lessened, it would be harder for her to still benefit off the same system. But the next question, I think, is, like, why does this still happen? Like, why do women still go into caring industries with a gender pay gap, that are lower paid? Why do they still do the majority of the housework and caring for kids? Because most people don't actually, I think, conceive of themselves like that a lot of the time. I think the answer to that is socialisation. Do people know, know that book? My mum had it when we were growing up. It's called Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. Yeah. So in that book, that's like, it's entirely about the idea that, yeah, men and women are like naturally, biologically have these differences. He says, a man's sense of self is defined through his ability to achieve results. But a woman's sense of self is defined through her feelings and the quality of her relationships, which is clearly idiotic. Like, women like achieving things. and also, I'm sure men enjoy relationships and feel good about them and stuff. men in the room can confirm that, maybe. So I think instead of it being natural for people to go into these roles and perform vastly different roles in society, people are socialised to be from that. They're raised in different ways, which push them towards different paths. So that happens all over the course of their childhood. There was a recent study done by the World Health Organization where they sent researchers into 15 different countries to look at gendered socialisation of kids. And the director of the study said, we found children at a very early age, from the most conservative to the most liberal societies, quickly internalise a myth that girls are vulnerable and boys are strong and independent. And that message is being constantly reinforced at almost every turn by siblings, classmates, teachers, parents, guardians, relatives, clergy and coaches. So women's socialisation, the way that they're raised even from the moment that they are newborns, prepares them to have an intense focus on their later family life. They're trained to be nurturing, to want children, and to play a disproportionate role in caring even for siblings when they're younger. That prepares them to turn inward later in life, to focus on the family unit rather than politics, their class, the struggles that go on around them. So gender is self-policed and self-reinforced. Whenever we look in the mirror in the morning, we're reminded of whether or not we are feminine enough, for example. And we go through a ritual of applying makeup to make ourselves fit more into our gendered roles. And all of our clothing choices sort of either reinforce it or don't. And we make that choice. But no matter which choice we make about whether we want to go against it or go with it, we're conscious of its existence in every single moment of life. As well as that, it's this that has meant homosexuality has been so heavily policed and persecuted and stigmatised, and it also means that trans people are particularly oppressed. So not conforming to your assigned gender has to mean being stigmatised, not to mention structurally oppressed, because otherwise, gendered socialisation wouldn't work properly. You can't enforce it as heavily without also punishing people who go against it. And because of that, I think anyone who wants to fight against women's oppression has to take up the fight against trans oppression and against homophobia as well. But I think the other important aspect of women's socialisation, apart from sort of pushing them into family roles, is making them feel vulnerable, underconfident and less assertive. For a small minority to run society and to get away with controlling all of the resources with extreme violent war and oppression, they need to try as hard as they can to prevent resistance against them. So the capitalist class has a whole series of mechanisms to try and make people less likely to resist, both within their own workplaces and also in terms of mass protest movements or mass strikes. And women's oppression is one of those mechanisms. Socialising half of society to be less confident and making it more difficult to for them to assert themselves, to feel immense insecurity and giving them the impression that their bodies are not their own. All of this helps the ruling class by making it harder for half of the population to fight back. And then as well as that, they're able to weaken the entire working class. So back to that question of whether is it the case that society is men versus women, with men oppressing women, or is it a case of there being one class oppressing another? I think that sort of applies to that. So you look at the way that, like, men's struggles as well are weakened through the oppression of women. In order for men to struggle for better working conditions, better wages, to struggle for more democratic societies, in order for any of this to happen, they need to do it collectively with women. Women are a key part of the struggle for basically any demand that men want to win to make their own lives better. And so if the capitalist class can make it harder for the entire working class to unite around these demands, harder for men and women to come together and actually fight around these demands, that hurts the ability for men to fight for their demands, to win their demands as well. And so working class men have a material interest in fighting against women's oppression and in fighting to empower working class men in that women in their struggles. An example of this is the work of the Builders Labourers Federation, which is a sort of construction union in Australia, who fought for women's right to work on construction sites. And Liz Ross, who wrote a lot about this, she writes, time and again, the boss would tell the women to go home because there was no job for them on the sites. On one occasion, a woman was ordered off a building site, and when she didn't leave, the boss called the cops. The men went on strike for the rest of the day, and then they went on strike for the following 2 weeks. And also, men who worked on other sites owned by the same company went on strike until this one woman was taken on and allowed to work. So working class men can play an important role in fighting women's oppression, and they also don't benefit out of it. But that doesn't mean they can't take up sexist ideas. And so I think one of the roles of socialists has to be constantly arguing with that, arguing to men that they should fight alongside women against their oppression. That capitalist men and women do benefit out of women's oppression. They've got an interest, a material interest, in maintaining women's oppression and subordination, just as they have an interest in oppressing the entire working class and using whatever social divisions they possibly can to intensify oppression. I was reading an article in Forbes magazine about how we can push against the stereotypes around women and stuff. And they say, we have to celebrate the role of individuals who are changing the world while simultaneously defying gendered stereotypes. Whether it's Chief Justices Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan, powerful women who are not mothers, or Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, who took a two-month paternity leave when his daughter was born. I guess I'd say Mark Zuckerberg taking paternity leave is not the fight, like the current fight for women's oppression. It's not taking it forward. He earns $1.5 billion each year. And it's completely insane, I think, to say that him hanging out with his daughter is helping us, or that Supreme Court justices not having kids takes for the struggle that all working class women actually go through. None of these reduce the heavy burden that working class people face in their lives, the need to go to work, to care for the kids, to maintain the household while wages are stagnating in this country. Another example, and so these people... another example is Kylie Jenner, who Chris mentioned yesterday in his talk. He's the world's youngest self-made millionaire. You can also look at Gina Reinhart. They make their money from exploiting working-class people and exploiting working-class women. And so I think we have to be clear on the fact that women from the capitalist class are not our allies. They're not the people who are fighting alongside us. And instead of saying that, you know, women getting into positions of power, going up in society, that is taking forward the struggle against women's oppression. I think what we have to be for is women, working class women, fighting against the oppression that they experience, fighting against their bosses alongside the men around them as well. So rather than conceiving of the struggle against women's oppression as one that is men versus women, I think we need to conceive of it as one that is class versus class. But that raises the question, is it possible to live in a society that doesn't have women's oppression? We're constantly told that it's always existed, that it's natural to humanity. But actually, it has not always existed. Before class divided societies existed, that it was not in any way the same. It didn't exist. And the sort of rise of class society and the rise of having a tiny minority which needs to oppress and dominate the majority, that was when they started to need to oppress women in the ways we talk about today. Before that, a lot of human societies around the world operated collectively in different groupings. Resources were distributed based on the need to feed and provide for the entire group rather than being distributed to entrench the profits of a few. And the role of women varied between these different groupings. Eleanor Burke-Lecoq, who's an anthropologist, explained the dynamic existing in the Montagnais Naskapi, which were sort of native people in Canada. She says, this is sort of from a record written by French Jesuits who went there to try and make them fit into capitalist sort of family norms. She says, the lack of a marked division of labour prevailed until recently in the camp. A man and his wife would come together from the woods, each carrying a log. A father and a daughter would saw together. A man might hold a fussing child and the mother would calmly do something else, feeling no compulsion to take over. A whole family would go off in a canoe to pull in fish nets. two young women would pick up some guns and go off to hunt rabbits. She got records written by, these sort of French Jesuits trying to impose capitalist gender norms on them. And one of them wrote, the choice of plans, of undertakings, of journeys, of winterings lies in nearly every instance in the hands of the housewife. And he still calls her the housewife, even though she's making all of the decisions. And in order to impose capitalist gender norms on the Montanese and Escapi, they had to use extreme levels of force. So the Jesuits had to do things like they forced children to go without food for days for any minor misdemeanour. A boy who was late to prayers had hot cinders thrown on his hands. It wasn't natural for women's oppression to come into being in this society. It had to be forced on people through violence. And so if it wasn't natural or biological for women to be... if it was natural for women to be oppressed, then societies like that couldn't exist, basically. If you're saying that it's built into humanity to oppress women, for women to play these roles, then it's actually impossible for any of these societies to have existed that make up the many, many thousands of years before capitalism existed. But just as women's oppression is violently forced upon people, we need to use force to get rid of it. So what does women's liberation look like, I think, is the first question. There's obviously been a few things that are painted as women's liberation today. So first of all, women's entering the workforce. I think we can safely say now that's happened and that is not liberation. As well as that, there's been a shift from sort of conservatism when it comes to the portrayal of women, modesty being upheld, towards raunch culture and hypersexualisation. And that often is portrayed as liberating as well. I think we have to say that is not women's liberation. Instead, it means that our sexualisation, we're being objectified, our sexuality is being used against us rather than us sort of, coming into it properly, being liberated. So I think instead we have to say liberation has to mean our ability to freely control our own sexuality and gender as well as our own working lives and to do these things in a collective, unalienated way. And that's not possible under capitalism. Capitalism subordinates everything to profit-making. Our family life, our reproductive rights, our sexuality, our work, everything is either commodified or put into the service of producing commodities to be sold on a market to make profit for capitalists. And so true liberation has to mean getting rid of the profit motive at the heart of society and instead placing human need there. We need to get rid of the capitalist class, which twists everything in society to prop themselves up and continue making profits. And I think it's only when human need, our collective relations and our ability to thrive are the central forces that drive society that we'll be able to achieve liberation. But then how do we get there? So I think to get rid of capitalism and with it women's oppression, we need a revolution. The working class and all of the oppressed need to overthrow the capitalist class, to take over our workplaces and to create a new democratic society based on collectivity. Revolutions happen recurringly under capitalism when people are pushed to the brink and they rebel. And when that happens, the oppressed are empowered to throw off their traditional roles, to lead and participate in mass struggles challenging their oppression. And so in 2011, women led revolutions across the Middle East. Women textile workers in Egypt began a mass uprising which toppled the dictator in Sudan earlier this year. People might have seen the banner that's around of Alaa Salah, who became the figurehead of the revolution that toppled the dictator Omar Bashir. And those demonstrations that toppled the dictator, constantly there are reports coming in saying that the majority of people in that were women. During the Russian Revolution of 1917, had an account by a woman in a rubber factory who sort of recalls the sense that she had of how this was transforming her own life. She says, when the revolution happens, I can't express my joy. I considered myself lost forever at the bosses, and suddenly I was resurrected, I grew up. That night I put on Russian boots and my husband's cap, a worker's overcoat, and I said farewell to my children and I left. I didn't appear at home for 4 days until March the 2nd. My family thought I'd been killed. And so throughout revolutions, the working class has the capacity to overthrow capitalism and reorganise society collectively, but also revolutions mean confronting all of the oppressions that exist for us in day-to-day life. So then what do we do in the here and now? Well, in the here and now, I think we need to push forward the confidence of the working class and women by fighting for whatever demands we possibly can. And Socialist Alternative today is involved in a whole series of campaigns against misogyny. So in Melbourne, we're part of the Campaign Against Racism and Fascism, which organises against the racist and misogynistic far right. Last year, we organised a counter rally against the March for Men, directly confronting these people and outnumbering them and scaring them away. When Trump was elected as president, we called a women's march in Australia, both to show solidarity with women in the US and also to confront the realities of sexism in Australia. And so I think we need to build up layers of people in society who are confident to fight collectively for their rights. But more than that, we need to organise around revolutionary ideas. So long as capitalism still exists, everything we fight for and win can be pushed back and eradicated. And I think you're seeing an example of that right now, when ideas in society are again shifting to become more and more sexist, when previously people had fought in the women's liberation movements to improve them. And so I think we need to fight to get rid of this system as a whole so that the gains we make can't be taken away from us or pushed back. We need to organise together with all of the other people who want to fight against capitalism and for a working class revolution which can end all oppression. And we need to argue in whatever movements we're part of that sexism has to be taken seriously. The working class men have an interest in fighting against sexism as well, and that fight has to be taken forwards. And all of those things, are the project of Socialist Alternative. But I'll leave it there. The questions that were asked, because I think they're really good. Like on the first thing about why not employ women just like on a mass scale more than already happens when they are like you can underpay them. And I think part of that is like that's part of the reason that women have entered the workforce on such a mass scale. And there are lots of industries which, like Catherine mentioned, textiles, in which they do try and predominantly employ women because they know they can pay them less. So that's significant. The other part of it, though, is that, like, women, for example, in Australia, women make up 68% of all casual workers because bosses in insecure industries, which is largely what casualisation means, know that they can get women to work in those industries more. And so they do kind of overrepresent women in insecure industries. But then also they have so much work to do that they also need to employ men still. And so men are still employed on a mass scale as well. On the thing about women being oppressed before capitalism, I think one of the important things about that is that, women under feudal societies and also ancient societies were oppressed in a whole series of ways. So under feudalism, you had kind of a family unit, sort of like today, and it was the thing that organised production, like organised the farm and stuff and farmed all of the grain, and you'd do it in your little house and as a family you'd have a farm and whatever. As well as that, in ancient societies, you kind of mentioned some of it. In ancient Greece, women were not citizens, for example, stuff like that. So women definitely were oppressed in these societies. And you could spend a long time explaining in each individual one why that was. But the general dynamic of it and the general reason for it is that in all of these societies, you had a minority who needed to oppress and extract profit or grain or whatever it was from a majority. So a minority had to oppress and rule over a majority and find ways of getting them to do stuff. And in order to do that, you need to oppress people. And so that means that, women were a key group that you needed to oppress in all of these different societies. And it's part of why I think we need to get rid of societies where a minority can rule over a majority in order to challenge oppression. Because in all societies where a minority has ruled over a majority, where class has existed, there has been oppression. The last thing on the question about stay-at-home mums, I think it's even broader than that. Because in general under capitalism, like it's a reality that people who are oppressed for all different reasons, whether it's women's oppression or other types, constantly feel less confident to part of the oppression, especially of women, but also applies to other groups, is to be less confident, less political, to try and push them into just like focusing inward on their lives, that kind of stuff. And so I think there's sort of two things to do about that. On the one hand, in the here and now, I think people are right to say we've got to sort of help people become political as much as we can. Draw them into different political scenarios, talk to them politically, all of that kind of stuff. But also, The points when women do much more feel confident to participate in political movements is when those movements are actually happening, and so building those is important. So, for example, when we called in Melbourne the Women's March, as the moment that Trump got elected, we called a Women's March in Melbourne. And then there were a few other people and women around who wanted to straight away get involved in organising that, who hadn't really been involved in activism before. And then at that protest, I was going around talking to people, and like a huge percentage of the people there had not ever been to protests and were not usually political people, but could be drawn into activism because it felt like there's something bigger than them going on. And so I think the bigger that we can build movements, the more capacity they have to draw in people who aren't usually confident to participate in them. And I wanted to give an example, which is people might have seen the amazing struggle going on in Hong Kong at the moment. There's like millions and millions of people demonstrating for democratic freedoms. And last week there was a mass protest that was called the Mothers Protest, where all of these, a lot of women in Hong Kong who are sort of consider themselves to be like traditional housewives who are mostly friends of their house, that kind of stuff. And these people organised consciously as we are kind of mothers and housewives, and we're going to take to the streets and protest as well, because how dare the police tear gas our children, and how dare they attack the mass movements? We support it too. And so that drew them into radicalism. And one of the main mothers who organised it, her name was Look, and she confronted armed police. There's all of these photos of her going along a police line and arguing with them and saying, how dare you shoot at my children? What would your children say about this? All of this stuff. And so they were drawn into a mass movement because as it emerged, they realised, yeah, this affects our lives as well. And so I think that's the way we can do sort of things in our lives in the here and now. But I think more broadly, we have to have an orientation to mass movements, to mobilising the vast majority of people, to helping draw vast layers of people into activism. Because the more that we can build up movements, the more that we look to situations like what's going on in Hong Kong right now and revolutions, that's the point where actually the oppressed can be properly yet drawn in and feel confident to assert themselves and to say, we want to be part of transforming society. We want to have a say. So, I think that's kind of the main thing to look to. But, thanks.